Well, thank you, Chad, for the songs that you had selected for us, and Rob for his comments. It's great to see you this morning. A few years back, the city of Beaverton started a half marathon, and they started it on Saturday. Then they shifted it to Sunday, and so we're one of the few, I think, businesses on the route or whatever that they definitely have to accommodate. Or when they initially set up the route, I think they forgot we were here. They forgot that our only access point actually is 5th Street. So the police department has been really good to work with us and accommodate access during this time. Great to have the Flighters with us this morning. It's always good to see them and our other visitors. Good to have the Ramseys able to be back after the birth of the new baby, and that's encouraging. Years ago, the Beatles released a song entitled Eleanor Rigby, and there was the lyrics include a repeated phrase in that song: all the lonely people, where do they all come from? All the lonely people, where do they belong? I still hear people talking about lonely people. In fact, the current generation, I'm not sure what the name for it, the next generation that they've labeled, they're kind of talking about some things I saw about that particular generation. But one of the things they said about that generation is they're very lonely. They're a very lonely generation. But here's what I hear more people talking about. I hear people talking about broken people. All the broken people. And what's interesting to me is that's not new terminology. About 6 centuries before Jesus was born, through the prophet Jeremiah, God said at least twice, they have healed the brokenness of my people. It's interesting that God speaks of his own people being broken, the people of Israel during that time. And what he's saying is that the false prophets of the time have just kind of put a band-aid on the problem of his people. And a lot of people are telling his people that are broken, everything's okay, everything's going to work out, everything's going to be fine, peace, peace. And God said, it's not okay, and it's not fine. And actually, there is no peace. It's interesting that sin, when it comes to not listening to God or when it comes to ignoring God, most people through the centuries, I think, have failed to realize that in not listening to God or in simply ignoring God, my life's going to start breaking down. And that's just going to be a natural consequence of that. And there's going to be some things in my life that are now going to be broken. In the book of Titus chapter 3, I think here's one passage that I would say kind of illustrates that point. That God had talked in Jeremiah about his people being broken, and I think here's another, you might say, definition of that condition. In the book of Titus chapter 3 and in verse 3, for we also once were foolish ourselves, disobedient, deceived, enslaved to various lusts and pleasures, spending our life in malice, envy, hateful, hating one another. I think that's another definition of a brokenness, of people being broken. Spending our life in, or spending our time in, that expression caught my attention in Titus chapter 3. Spending our life in. What did I spend my life doing this week? What have I spent my life doing the last month? Or the last 5 or 10 years of my life, what have I spent my life doing? And I guess particularly what I'm asking is, what mood did I occupy most of this week? Because, I think
if we have the advantage of being on a deathbed, some people don't ever end up on a deathbed, they just die. But if you're there on your deathbed and you know the end is coming, or if one day when I'm standing before God in judgment, I think I'm going to probably say to myself, I spent way too much time feeling sorry for myself. I spent way too much time being angry. I spent way too much time being bitter. I spent way too much time fantasizing about things that had no connection with reality. Or I spent way too much time lusting or whatever it may be. I spent way too much of my life doing something that was not only wrong, but it was just absolutely counterproductive. I spent too much of my life worrying. Or here's another one. I spent too much of my life being afraid. Being afraid. In Romans chapter 1, I would say, would be another section of what I would describe as brokenness. Being filled with all unrighteousness, wickedness, greed, evil, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malice, they are gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, arrogant, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, without understanding, untrustworthy, unloving, unmerciful. But it's easy to believe that that's not going to happen to me. I think there's just a lot of people today, or maybe there have always been a lot of people like this, who feel that I can ignore God or kind of put Him on a shelf or not listen to Him, and yet I can still remain whole and good and put together and buttoned up, and I can continue to function very well in life. This is a passage that caught my attention with that thought. It's Colossians chapter 1, verse 21. And I thought it was just interesting the way the Holy Spirit worded it. And although you were formerly alienated and hostile in mind. Now that's in reference to God. Alienated and hostile in mind to God. He does not say, although you were formerly alienated and hostile in mind, and yet pretty good people otherwise. He says, alienated and hostile in mind and engaged in evil deeds. And my thought from the verse is, if I've got a beef with God, if I've got a bone to pick with God, if I'm angry at God, I'm upset at God, I cannot quarantine that and say, I'm angry at God, but I've got it quarantined, and my anger at God is not going to spill over into any other aspect of my life. That verse says, you were alienated from God, and you were hostile in mind to God and His truth, and it spilled over into the rest of your life. You were engaged in evil deeds. That is, you ended up hurting other people in the process. Now and then someone will say, and sometimes when they're dating someone, they will say, I'm dating a guy and he's mean to everybody else, but he's not mean to me. And I might say, well, I think someone might be able to do that for a while. But eventually they're going to be being mean to you as well. Because I don't think you can quarantine stuff like that and say, I'm going to be mean to everybody else but not this particular person. Jesus also noted that the two great commandments, love God with all your heart and love your neighbor as yourself, are connected, that you cannot disconnect those two commands. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and with all your mind. Verse 37 of Matthew 22. This is the great and foremost commandment. The second is like it. And you might say, well, why did Jesus immediately go to the second? Well, I think because you have to immediately go to the second. Because there's going to be immediately something there. And the second is, You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend the whole law on the prophets. That is, every command out there fits somewhere in those two basic principles. It's either a manifestation of your love for God, or it's a manifestation of your love for God and love for others. So if I'm thinking I can take God and remove Him from my life, and yet continue to love people as I should, I'm really deceiving myself. A couple other passages. Jesus said in John 8:34, everyone who commits sin is the slave of it. And it's almost like, and there's no exceptions to that rule, it's going to enslave you. And he who is not with me is against me, and he who does not gather with me scatters. That's verses always struck me that Jesus said, hey, if you're not with me, there's a lot of people that might say something like, well, I'm not really doing anything for God, but I'm not out there actively opposing him either. And Jesus would say, that's not true. If you're not trying to gather souls with me, you're scattering. You're working against, whether you realize or not, you're working against me. You are part of the problem. One application would be, say, I ignore God, I depart from God, I get in trouble. I ask you to cover for me. I grew up in a culture, I think, that when I didn't grow up as a member of in a family that remembers the church, but I think in the greater culture I grew up in, a common philosophy was, hey, if it's family, you protect family. You know, if some family member gets in trouble with the law, you lie for them, or you hide them, or whatever, or if they're trying to cover assets, hey, you know, they're trying to get my car, you know, I'm not paying my wife or whatever, I'm not sure, can I put my car in your garage so they can't get it, you know, and I think the thought is that you do everything, it's blood, and you take care of blood. And the thing is that if you got any family member that ever comes to you and says, will you lie for me or cover for me, what you need to understand is that they don't care at all about you at that moment. If they're willing to ask you to do something that could get you into trouble, the only person they're thinking about is them. And I think that's a good example of where we go to, I ignore God, and immediately I'm involving someone else in my sin. Where you can't quarantine things like that. Another application would be that I ignore God, I get into trouble, or I live a life apart from God, and now I tell my story. But the problem is that now my story blames parents, loved ones, relatives, a current or a former spouse, members of the church, elders somewhere, whatever. And now my story is shifting the blame to other people. I don't know how Judgment Day is going to go. I've got this picture that we're standing there and we're waiting and there's a line and stuff like that and everyone is heard, etc. But one of the passages that really strikes me is that passage where Jesus said, when the people of Capernaum are out there at the Judgment Day, is that another group of people is going to rise up, the men of Nineveh, and point the finger at them and say, hey. And that passage tells me is that at Judgment Day, if I start spinning a story, there may be a whole number of people in the crowd that say, whoa, 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 that's not the way that happened. Sometimes when people come to me and say, hey, I got all these problems and I'm in need and I need money or whatever, I wish that the extended family was there telling me, like, is this true? Is this true? They may say yes, or oh, that's not really the way that happened. Maybe one of the things that you can be helpful in your life is that when you hear someone telling a story and that's not true, is to say, whoa, whoa, whoa. No, that's not the way it happened. I was there. That is not the way that happened. So when I'm attempting to put my moral and spiritual failures at the doorstep of someone else, to me that says, right now I'm only concerned about myself. When I talk about a total breakdown, to me it just is the idea that I think sin seeps in. I let it in and it's going to seep in and it's going to touch every aspect of my life. Because it's a harsh environment. And in order to ignore God, I just have to change myself. Jeremiah chapter 6, verse 15. Jeremiah said, and here's one of the things where I think it affect their sensitivity. It affect their how tender their heart was. Were they ashamed because of the abomination they have done? They were not even ashamed at all. They did not even know how to blush. They couldn't even kind of feel a sense of embarrassment anymore. And being able to blush is a good thing. I think in our culture sometimes being able to blush is that you're viewed as naive or you are sheltered, etc. Being able to blush is a good thing. Don't ever take that for granted. Our relationships, it's going to affect our relationships. It's going to affect our honesty. I wanted to look at, I had a passage there in John chapter 3, but actually I wanted to look at, I think, something else there. In Luke chapter 11, in verse 15, but some of them said, he cast out demons by Beelzebub, the ruler of the demons. How could you hear Jesus teach? And how could you see his personal example? And how could you see his miracles and then say that? Because I'm going like, there's no honesty in that argument. Well, he's only cast out demons by the power of Satan. That makes absolutely no sense at all. But sometimes there are things that we say that don't make any sense at all either. Either excuses that we make or whatever that don't make any sense at all. Sometimes it's just good to, you know, to come clean. And instead of making excuses, just to say, right now I just don't trust God as much as I should. just say it for what it is. Just say it for what it is. And our self-control. This is one, I guess, that scares me a little bit, is I can actually lose the grip with reality. And I don't have to be on the street talking to myself to have lost a hold on what's real. I can lose sight of what's real long before that. In the book of 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 10, and with all deception of wickedness for those who perish, because they did not receive the love of the truth so as to be saved. For this reason, God will send upon them a deluding influence so that they will believe what is false, in order that they may all be judged who did not believe the truth but took pleasure in wickedness. I want to be able to have a grip on what's real and what's true. And there is a God, that's true.
And this is His Word, and that's true. And Jesus died for my sins, and that's true. And I'm going to answer for how I've treated other people. That's true. That's true. There's a statement over in the book of Luke chapter 13 that Jesus, it's like Matthew 7, but it's a little different than Matthew 7, 21 through 22. Someone says, Jesus, are there just going to be a few people that are going to be saved? And He says, strive to enter through the narrow door, for many, I tell you, will seek to enter and will not be able. And He said, once the house is filled and the door is shut, there's going to be people out there banging on the door. And here's what they're going to say, Lord, open to us. And then Jesus says, I'm going to say, I don't know where you're from. I don't know who you are. And then they're going to say, we ate and drank in your presence and you taught in our streets. What's that? I think what that is, well, we hung out with you. You know, when there was that big feeding or whatever, we were there. We hung out with you. We had a meal with you. We heard your sermons. We even got copies of your sermon notes. And they think that's going to get them in. We know who you are. We hung out with you in the afternoon. We had a meal with you. And we heard some of your sermons. What's the problem? I mean, obviously we're in. And yet that's not even close to being in. And yet, I think that's a good example of their view of reality was completely off. And sin gets it there and tries to mess with you. I don't know about you, but the devil's always trying to mess with my head, always trying to mess with my reality. The devil's always trying to tell me, like, hey, you know, you're deprived, or you don't have enough, or you should feel sorry for yourself, or you should be angry about that, or you should be bitter about this, and he's also trying to tell me that God's standard is, you know, a lot lower than what I think it is. He's always trying to convince me of that as well. I don't know about you, but every day he's trying to mess with my head and mess with my view of what's real. And this is a brokenness where I place me first. And I become calloused, insensitive, short-sighted, opt for what's here and before me instead of the long-term reward. It will create situations in which my children might be hungering, there is no food at home, and I will take the $300 doing something, and instead of buying groceries for the family, I opt to buy some marijuana, booze, and clothes for myself. And that's a true story. And there's too much of that happens in our world. And the frustrating things at times when someone does that and you go like, what is that? They don't think there's anything wrong with that. Or that has become their norm. There are thousands of alternatives that people rush to when they're broken. And I don't think anything's really changed. I think pretty much the alternatives that people rush to in Jeremiah's time are pretty much a lot of the alternatives that people rush to today. My people have committed two sins or two evils. They have forsaken me, the spring or fountain of living water, and have dug their own cisterns, broken cisterns that cannot hold water. Here's the thing that struck me, is that when these people left God, they immediately tried to find a substitute. It's not like they left God and say, oh, we don't need a substitute. They left God and immediately something in them said, we need a substitute. We need a replacement.
And they immediately went out and tried to dig something that would do what God did for them. God's this living fountain, this spring of fresh water. And so they went out and said, well, we'll dig a cistern. But the problem is that all these humanly devised replacements can't hold any water. Broken cisterns, I think they've been the same over the centuries. Money, stuff, gold, riches, possessions, status, fame, I'm somebody, a career, money, sex, power, various forms of drugs and alcohol. Broken cisterns. And my thought is, what are you throwing yourself into right now? What are you just throwing yourself into? Where are you just expanding yourself? You're just putting yourself out in that area. Where are you going the second mile? Because to me, if it's not the relationship with God and all that involves, if it's not that relationship with God and serving Him and helping others, etc., then I think I'm just digging a hole. I'm just digging a hole. And at the end of my life, I'm going to look at that big hole I dug, and it's not going to have any water in it. Not only that, but I think that big hole I dug when I'm dying, I don't think that's going to help me at all. You know, the sad thing is broken cisterns can also be your tomb. You're looking for it for meaning and purpose, and you're looking for it for something. But I think we've all known people that have thrown all their time into a career and lost their family and lost their kids where the career buried them. There are people that have thrown themselves into sexual addiction and have lost everything. There are people that have thrown themselves into alcohol or drugs or you name it, and it's taken everything. Is that really look at the hole you're digging? If you're throwing your life into something and it really has nothing to do with God, that may be your grave. There are places in the Bible where I run into broken people, but they're defiant. I mean, they're broken, but like Jeremiah 6:15, were they ashamed? Or 44:10, but they have not become contrite even to this day. That last passage is where the people are no longer in their land. Jerusalem has been leveled. A whole bunch of people have been taken hostage. They're down in, I think they're down in Egypt. They've lost everything. They've experienced hardship. And even at that point in Jeremiah 44, the people are like, we're not changing. We're not changing. I was reading a book last night about one view that some people have of hell, which is not true. One view is that eventually everyone ends up saved and eventually everyone bows their knee to God. Sometimes, some people just take a whole lot more time than other people. But eventually, even the most defiant sinner that's ever lived is finally going to come back to God and say, you're right. And first of all, I don't know of any passage in the Bible that teaches anything close to that. But secondly, don't underestimate human stubbornness. Bible also talk when the book of Proverbs talks about like a broken spirit, what can heal or who can heal, I think those passages have to be in the context of a broken spirit without God. Without God, yeah, there's no remedy for a broken spirit without God.
I guess when I say don't ever underestimate human stubbornness, I have seen people in life that are miserable, and they say they're miserable. They're miserable, their wife is miserable, their kids are miserable, everyone's miserable. But not so miserable that they'll say, I'm going to pick up the Bible and start reading it and look for answers, or I want help. I've just been amazed at the amount of misery a person can be in and still not ask God for help. Gregory's lesson. Asa. In the book of 2 Chronicles chapter 16 verse 12. Near the end of his life, Asa was the king that was diseased in his feet. And it says it was severe. That is, it's not like he has the toenail fungus. It's like it was really, really bad. And yet the text says, yet even in his disease, he did not seek the Lord, but the physicians. Nothing wrong with a doctor. I mean, Jesus said those who are sick need a physician. The thought is, though, he didn't come to God and pray and ask for God's help. Don't be that guy. Don't be Asa. Don't be the guy that I am in misery right now, but I'm not asking God for help. Or I'm in misery and I'm not going to get my life right. But here's the people that God says, you know what? There are people who are broken and they know they're broken. And they realize that God is the only answer for our brokenness. That only God can help us put our lives back together. And God's always willing to help a person like that. The sacrifices of God, David said, are a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart, O God, you will not despise. You might say, after adultery with Bathsheba and having Uriah killed, how could David get his life back together? Well, he could. You know, the nursery rhyme about Humpty Dumpty is true, but it's also not true. You can be a Humpty Dumpty and fall off the wall and be cracked all over the place and pieces everywhere. You know, people say, well, you can't unscramble an egg. Well, there is an exception to that, is that with God, you can be like Humpty Dumpty. And God says, I can help you get it back together. Now, you may still have some cracks that will always be there. But we can get you back to be, you know, we can get the yolk back in the egg. You may not be the prettiest egg, but we can get your life back together. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, Isaiah 61 verse 1. Jesus said as he began his public ministry. But to this one I will look, to him who is humble and contrite of spirit, and who trembles at my word, Isaiah 66 2. I dwell in a high and holy place, and also with the contrite and lowly of spirit. Without God, I'm going to hurt myself. And I'm going to hurt others. And I'm going to lead others astray. I'm going to mess up my relationships. I'm going to develop a distorted view of myself and others in reality. And without God at a critical time, I will bail and I will not be available and I will not be useful at a critical time. And I will not be around. There are too many broken people in this world. We don't need any more.
we don't need any more. If anyone cleanses himself from what is dishonorable, he will be a vessel for honorable use, set apart as holy, useful to the master of the house, ready for every good work.
With God, I want to be someone that with God, when other people need to lean on me, I'm there and I don't snap. Maybe there's one here this morning. The Bible says, he that believeth and is baptized shall be saved. It's okay to say, I am a mess right now. Been there. I'm a mess right now. I need help. Everyone here who's been baptized knows what that feels like. I'm messed up right now. I need some help. God is there. God is available. God is available this morning. And let's get ourselves right with God so that we're able to help other people. As we stand and as we sing in the invitation song.